Then in the evening allowed you to eat anything up to 800 calories. Even with the nightly binge, I felt deprived, and I hated it. I tried another diet that started with 100 days of food replacement shakes only, coupled with neuro-linguistic programming and cognitive behavioral therapy to address food addiction. I lost 66 pounds, but when I started introducing foods again, it was impossible for me to control my portions, and I put it all back on. Then I got pregnant. After my son was born, I just hated my body so much. My stomach felt like a bottomless pit, like I would never know fullness, ever. So I thought the best thing would be bariatric surgery. I went to see a surgeon for my 40th birthday, and he looked at me and said, "I've never seen a fat vegan before. If you can be vegan, you can do anything. You're just not being strong-willed enough." I was so humiliated I binged for 2 months. And then a friend posted Susan's food freedom videos on social media. She saved my life. For years I had thought, what's wrong with me? I watched the videos and thought, I can solve this. There is a solution. Then I joined Bright Line Eating and discovered there was nothing wrong with me, only with what I'd been eating. It wasn't easy to begin with. I was really miserable because of the quantities. For 5 weeks, I felt like I was starving. I was really tired and fatigued. But I stuck with it, because I knew I was drowning, and this was my rescue boat. After 7 weeks, it became bearable. Then, after 3 months, it became easy. Now I can't imagine my life any other way. Everything has changed. I don't hate myself, and I don't hate my body. I've never experienced those feelings before in my life. Ever. The madness isn't there anymore. I've found peace, and I've really met myself now. The best version of me has emerged from this process.
Part 2. The Bright Line Eating Solution. Bridging the Willpower Gap. A quick note. If you've just bought this book and flipped to this chapter because you want to cut to the chase, I strongly encourage you to go back and read the first 5 chapters. You will find out what to do in this chapter to get happy, thin, and free, but if you don't know why you're doing it, your chances of success are much lower. That's just a scientific fact. Chapter 6. The Four Bright Lines. Now you understand how your brain is blocking you from getting happy, thin, and free, and why every diet you have committed to so strongly in the past has ultimately failed you. Insulin levels have crept up, blocking leptin at the brainstem, so the all-important signal, "Ugh, no more eating, I'm full," simply never arrives. And if your dopamine receptors have downregulated too, then it's taking more and more sugar and flour throughout the day to deliver the same feeling of okayness. In the past, you've pledged and committed to eat right, but fighting against your brain takes every drop of focus and effort you've got, and sometimes, despite all of your resolve and best intentions, the strains of the day wear away at you and the willpower gap is right there waiting. Add to all that a voice in your head that is constantly manipulating you, urging you to make an exception just this once, and a consciousness that has watched you struggle and concluded you're not trustworthy, so why bother? It's no wonder you felt hopeless about the prospect of ever losing all your excess weight and keeping it off. In truth, up until now, it has been hopeless. The way out. There is only one long-term, sustainable solution to this mess that I have ever seen work. It worked for me, and I've seen it work for thousands of others. Give up sugar and flour. Completely. Get them out of your system quickly and definitively. And it's possible you want to throw this book across the room. It's also possible that you were given this book by someone who has lost and kept off over 100 pounds, so you're willing to keep an open mind. Either way, you're probably asking me right now, isn't that extreme? To which I reply, I'll tell you what's extreme. Each year, In the United States alone, over 70,000 people have to get a limb amputated because of their type 2 diabetes. 70,000 people. And their doctors have warned them that it's coming. But it doesn't matter. They can't stop. They eat until they lose a limb. That is extreme. That is how powerful this addiction is. Giving up processed drug foods isn't extreme. What's extreme is the way our society eats and the consequences we've decided we're willing to tolerate as a result. And of course the answer is to quit. When someone is losing critical lung function because they smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day, we don't tell them to moderate their smoking. We tell them they need to quit. But how, you're asking? Cigarettes are easy to avoid, food is everywhere, and I have to eat to survive, and there are special things I love to eat that have sugar and flour in them, and I don't know if I could give them up forever, and you've just pointed out how hard it is to stick with anything. I hear you. And it's okay to feel panicked. That's actually coming from the dopamine receptors in your nucleus accumbens. They're about to get their supply cut off, and they don't like it. Not one little bit. Which is why I'm happy to tell you that this program is stronger than they are. Your brain will heal, and there's a very, very bright future ahead of you. Relax, it won't be nearly as bad as you think. Bright Lines to the Rescue. After I'd been in a right-sized body for over a decade and had spent years and years helping people in my community to lose hundreds of pounds as a spiritual service, I discovered Roy Baumeister's book, Willpower. He's the scientist who performed the famous radish experiment described in Chapter 1. Toward the end of the book, on page 185, he talks about Eric Clapton's alcoholism and says this. He needs the help of bright lines, a term borrowed from lawyers. These are clear, simple, unambiguous rules. You can't help but notice when you cross a bright line. If you promise yourself to drink or smoke moderately, that's not a bright line. It's a fuzzy boundary with no obvious point at which you go from moderation to excess. Because the transition is so gradual and your mind is so adept at overlooking your own peccadilloes, you may fail to notice when you've gone too far. So you can't be sure you're always going to follow the rule to drink moderately. In contrast, zero tolerance is a bright line. Total abstinence with no exceptions anytime. I was reading this and I was on fire. Yes, I thought. I'd been living by bright lines for years in relation to drugs and alcohol, but had never heard this term before. I loved it. The mental image it conjured up almost had a spiritual feeling to me, like those sharp beams of sunlight that break through the clouds and make my heart fill with bliss. But then in the book, Baumeister goes on to say, it's not practical for all self-control problems. A dieter cannot stop eating all food. I was stunned. I thought, oh, Roy, fumble. Can't you see? Bright lines are perfect for food. I stared at that paragraph for what felt like ages. I was trying to assimilate the fact that Roy Baumeister, one of the most preeminent psychologists in the world, with over 30 books and over 600 publications to his name, believes that you can't use bright lines for food because you have to eat to live. Yes, you have to eat to live, but you don't have to eat donuts to live. It was then that I truly grasped the chasm that existed between everything I knew to be true about the science and practice of effective weight loss and the state of thinking in the rest of the field. I let it all sink in. Not many days after I read that paragraph, the words, bright line eating, came to me during my morning meditation session, and I resolved to write this book. So, bright lines. Clear, simple, unambiguous boundaries that you just don't cross. We have arrived, finally, at the heart of the matter. The most important contribution of the bright lines is that they bridge the willpower gap. Bright lines give you clear rules for what you can and can't put in your mouth. And the result is that your eating choices become automatic. You don't have to think about them. There is no decision to make. It doesn't matter that it's 4 p.m. and you have a tray of donuts in front of you. You will stand there knowing exactly what you're going to eat next, and those donuts won't be it. Bright lines enable you to stop thinking about food and to stop grappling with those 221 food-related choices that we mentioned earlier. There is only one choice. Respect the bright lines. Bright line eating, as I've devised it, consists of four bright lines. Sugar, flour, meals, and quantities. In this chapter, I'm going to outline each bright line in depth and explain the science behind why they work. Bright line number one, sugar. This is really the cardinal bright line. Without it, none of the others are effective because you have to take sugar out of the equation to allow the brain and therefore the body to heal. Now, to be clear, by sugar, I mean all added sugar. It appears as dozens and dozens of names on ingredient lists, including but not limited to cane sugar, beet sugar, date sugar, brown sugar, powdered sugar, evaporated cane juice, rice syrup, corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, honey, agave, maple syrup, molasses, sucrose, dextrose, indeed anything ending in O-S-E, maltitol, glycerin, malted barley extract, and maltodextrin. Any food containing any of these ingredients has to be eliminated because all refined forms of fructose and glucose hit our insulin system harder than our bodies were designed to withstand. Elevated baseline insulin levels then block leptin, leading to insatiable hunger and sedentary behavior. And the sugar pounds our dopamine receptors, leading to downregulation and overpowering cravings. In order for your brain to heal, your insulin and dopamine systems must be allowed to rest so they can recalibrate back to their original settings. Artificial sweeteners. Artificial sweeteners are a menace. True, they have zero calories, so the body cannot use them for fuel, but they impact the insulin system just the same as sugar. The sweet taste hits the tongue and causes a dopamine surge and insulin response, even though no corresponding calories are forthcoming. And in 2014, researchers discovered an additional mechanism by which artificial sweeteners cause glucose intolerance, by altering our gut microbiota. Finally, research shows that in some organisms, artificial sweeteners mimic a starvation state in the brain, leading to a 50% increase in later food consumption. Don't be fooled. Artificial sweeteners will absolutely derail your weight loss success. By artificial sweeteners, I mean saccharin, NutraSweet, aspartame, sucralose, xylitol, sorbitol, and yes, stevia and Truvia. In addition, many non-food products containing artificial sweeteners, like diet soda and sugarless gum, will keep you hooked on the behavior of putting something in your mouth as a crutch to get through the day. Take a deep breath and let them go. Fruit. The good news is that fresh fruit is just fine. In fact, fruit is wonderful. I'm happy to say that you can eat any and all varieties of whole, fresh fruit. The fructose in fresh fruit doesn't impact the brain and body like refined sugar does because when you eat a piece of fruit, you eat fiber as well. Fruit's fiber lattice is composed of soluble and insoluble fiber that slows the absorption of the fruit's natural sugar into the bloodstream, blunting insulin and dopamine responses. What we shouldn't eat is dried fruit, fruit juice, or blended fruit. In each of these, the sugar content is more concentrated than the fiber lattice can inhibit. Imagine sitting down and eating 6 fresh apricots, for example. It would probably take you quite a few minutes, and you'd most likely get bored with eating them before you could even get through them all. Now imagine eating 6 dried apricots. You could do that in seconds, and the only thing you'd be thinking is, more please. Remember, we want to keep that part of your brain, those dopamine receptors, quiet. I get asked all the time whether juicing and smoothies are allowed, and the answer is no. Here's why. The soluble and insoluble fiber in fruits and vegetables work together to form a barrier that keeps the fructose from rushing through your gut lining and flooding into your bloodstream. the fiber barrier is kind of like the roof of a thatched hut. The insoluble fiber is not digestible. Insoluble. Think of it as the twigs or bamboo that you'd use to make the roof of the hut. The soluble fiber does gradually dissolve. It's soluble, like the packing mud on the hut. Once you take that whole fruit, or vegetable as the case may be, and put it in a blender or a juicer, you shred the fiber lattice, leaving all that fructose and glucose free to hit your system as fast as if you just consumed a piece of candy. Cravings. The next thing that I'm usually asked is, if I quit sugar, won't I have cravings? And the answer is, yes, you will. At the beginning, Brightline eating is very similar to quitting smoking. But the cravings will go away. Not instantly, but by the end of my 8-week boot camp, 84% of people report having few to no cravings anymore, ever. Some people, like me for instance, experience cravings for a while longer. But I promise they go away. The craving is just the last-ditch effort of your hijacked brain to get you back on the sauce. But you will become stronger than that. The next few chapters will help you put systems in place to get through those cravings so your brain can keep healing and you can reach your goal weight. And, finally, stay there. Bright line number 2. Flour. The second bright line is flour. In my opinion, it's the wiliest. Bear with me on this because it's vitally important. Most people are so wary of sugar that they let flour sneak in under the radar and sabotage their success. In the 20 years I spent working with and observing people in various 12-step food programs, I saw this happen over and over again. People gave up sugar, but they kept eating flour. Or they gave up white flour, but kept eating brown flour. So they stayed heavy. Or they gave up wheat flour, but they ate oat flour, almond flour, coconut flour, and they stayed heavy. Before I developed Brightline Eating, I tried giving up sugar without giving up flour. What happened to me is that I mourned the loss of my cookie dough because there's no cookie dough without sugar. But then it dawned on me that I also used to love pie crust dough. So I started to eat that. I also started focusing on pasta, quesadillas, corn chips, chow mein, pizza, pot stickers, English muffins, and more pasta. I ate a lot of French fries and potato chips too, which technically don't have flour in them, but I now know that the inside of a white potato is the molecular equivalent of straight flour, just pure glucose without fiber. Essentially, my brain cued me to escalate my flour intake to compensate for the dopamine loss from sugar. So I actually gained weight. It's a classic mistake. I urge you not to make it. We don't have research on this yet, but I believe there are individual differences in whether the brain prefers to get its fix from sugar versus flour. In my experience, about 80% of people are primarily sugar-focused. But there's a slice of the population, that other 20%, who will openly admit that they don't like sweets much at all. Just don't take away their bread. Those percentages are just my guesstimate from having worked with so many people. I would love to see a study done on it. The science of flour addiction is in its infancy. We know that flour raises insulin levels, but we don't have the smoking gun of flour flooding the dopamine receptors. Yet. But let me remind you of that anecdote about putting sauce and cheese on broccoli. No one has ever driven out in the rain at 3 a.m. to get that. Why do people rate pizza as the number one most addictive food in existence? It's the flour. All flour. Just as with sugar, the bright line for flour is all flour. It's not about the type of plant. It's not even about gluten. It's about surface area. When the grain is processed, ground down to make flour, the surface area of each particle gets multiplied exponentially. This is true for whole grain flour too. When the surface area is increased, our digestive enzymes have a field day accessing the glucose, and it hits the system too fast and too hard. My dear friend, Dr. Alan Christensen, gave me a great analogy for this. He said he thinks about the digestive process as akin to melting ice. Eating a whole grain food, like brown rice, for example, is like taking a huge square block of ice and leaving it on a hot driveway to melt. It will, but slowly, over the course of many hours. Eating brown rice flour, in contrast, is like sprinkling ice shavings all over a hot black driveway. They melt on contact. Sugar and flour affect the body in slightly different ways, which is why it's important to give them up in tandem. Sugar primarily breaks down into glucose and fructose. Flour breaks down into just glucose. Fructose can only be processed by the liver, which is why we're seeing such high incidence of fatty liver disease in our culture. Flour hits all the cells. Think about that. It's a full body assault. Bright line number 3, meals. Eliminating sugar and flour is a good start, but if that's all you do, odds are you won't be successful long term. Eventually, you'll fall prey to the willpower gap and your efforts won't last. This is where the bright line for meals comes in. When regular meals become part of the scaffolding of your life, it takes the burden off of willpower. A lot. When you set up a schedule of eating 3 meals a day at regular mealtimes, breakfast at breakfast time, lunch at lunchtime, and dinner at dinner time, not only does eating the right things become automatic, but passing up the wrong things in between also becomes automatic. At first, you may find breaking your long-standing habit of eating between meals to be quite hard, because you're probably not used to prioritizing eating at mealtimes. And you're probably not eating enough food at mealtimes. But the bright line of meals is a habit that can be established fairly rapidly, and from then on it will serve you well. It may even improve the lives of those around you. As I said earlier, as a culture, we've lost the concept of real meals. We graze all day. There's no time of day now where food is not on offer. And if you or your loved ones are prone to food addiction, like those sign-tracking rats we talked about, this means that your whole day has become like one long series of magnetic cues that pull you in and result in food going into your mouth without you necessarily even being aware of it. In short, if you allow yourself to eat between meals, you're sunk. You'll never get thin that way, or happy or free, for that matter. The bright line for meals means eating 3 bountiful, abundant, delicious meals every day, with absolutely nothing in between. Now, bright line beverages are fine. I'll tell you more about those in Chapter 8. If you're thinking, "But I get hungry at 4 o'clock. I need a snack." I can honestly tell you, after working with thousands of people, you don't. Or rather, you won't, once you get your blood glucose stabilized and your insulin under control. 3 meals a day will be fine. Even people who start bright line eating with a diagnosis of hypoglycemia typically find that it resolves quite quickly, that it was caused not by an underlying physiological disorder, but rather by the sugar and flour they were eating all the time. There are situations where more or fewer meals per day are called for. But in these cases, the bright line for meals, with no grazing and no snacking, still holds. It's just that the number of meals varies. Here are some examples. When I was pregnant with twins, I ate 6 meals per day. But they were meals that I planned out and ate with attention. And, just to note, 3 years later, when I was pregnant with just one baby, I happily and healthily ate just 3 meals a day throughout the entire pregnancy. And the day I climbed Half Dome, I ate 6 meals. But just on that one day, during shorter training hikes leading up to the big climb, I stuck to my 3-meal schedule. Sometimes, but not always, gastric bypass patients have to eat smaller, more frequent meals. It depends on how much time has passed since the surgery and how their body responds to the Bright Line Eating food plan. Bodybuilders and athletes on a serious training regimen are another group that may need more than three meals. In addition, some of my clients with eating disorders who come to Brightline Eating to get their weight up can't actually handle the portion size of Brightline meals and have to break them up at first. As I said, there are noteworthy exceptions, but in my experience, the vast majority of people are well served by three meals a day. Eating meals on a regular schedule also confers a long list of powerful health benefits. It dramatically increases the fasting window, the number of hours that you go without ingesting any food at all, up to roughly 11 to 14 hours. A 13-hour fasting window is accomplished, for example, if you finish dinner by 6 p.m. and eat breakfast starting at 7 a.m. the next morning. And this increases fat loss, improves energy levels, and facilitates a good night's sleep. A nice long fasting window also increases something called autophagy, which is the process by which your cells recycle and repair their broken and poorly working parts, boosting your protection against infection and disease. And eating meals at consistent times improves insulin sensitivity, lowers cholesterol, and supports fat loss. When it comes to diet and exercise programs, the cultural zeitgeist leans heavily toward recommending snacking. So it might be wise for us to take a moment to debunk some popular myths about eating throughout the day. The first myth is that eating small meals throughout the day keeps your metabolism revving and increases energy expenditure. There's a lot of research on this, and it's simply not true. Your metabolic rate will be the same whether you eat three bigger meals or six smaller meals per day. It might even be better with fewer bigger meals. So what are the supposed benefits of snacking? After all, I can't think of a single diet or eating plan other than Brightline Eating and a handful of 12-step food programs that advocates three meals a day with nothing in between. Every other eating plan that I'm aware of builds in snacks. Maybe the thought is that snacks keep you from getting hungry and are just necessary, that without them people would want food all the time and feel deprived. Well, there's research on this too, and actually, in some populations at least, it's the reverse. It's eating all day long that keeps people thinking about food, obsessed with eating, and feeling hungry again right after putting food in their mouths. Eating at regular mealtimes alleviates all that. So, in practice, what does the bright line for meals look like? Well, here's a picture for you. In the morning, shortly after waking, you will sit down for a bright line breakfast. Eating while seated is important. There, on your table, you set out the food you've planned to eat. It doesn't happen in your car, on the sidelines of soccer games, at the movies, or on your couch. It's time to eat when you're at the table. By shifting the cues your body uses to recognize acceptable times for consuming food, you shift them away from everything else that used to trigger you. Lunch may have to be at your desk, but this can work if you eat at a set time every day. Again, I ask you to be mindful. Turn off your computer. Maybe give thanks. The same for dinner. Consider weaning yourself off of the habit of eating dinner in front of the TV. Entertainment can be a cue to relax or to share a laugh or a cry with friends and family, but it shouldn't be a cue to eat. Resetting the brain this way isn't easy at first in our on-the-go culture, but it's worth the effort. Again, primarily because once your brain is really clear about where it eats, it becomes really clear about where it doesn't eat, and those endless cues for us sign trackers finally fade into the background. Bright line number four, quantities. The fourth and final bright line has to do with quantities. This is the bright line that clicks everything into place and ensures that your weight will melt off and leave you in a right-sized body. Postmenopausal? On medications that increase your hunger? Obesity run in your family? Hypothyroidism? No worries. The bright line for quantities has got your back. The quantities of bright line meals are generous, but they are finite. Remember that the majority of adults no longer receive reliable signals to stop eating from their brains and are no longer able to compensate for the extra calories they've consumed. And almost no one who is overweight these days is able to consistently choose portions that will result in them losing all their excess weight and keeping it off. So we take your judgment out of the equation. I recommend a digital food scale. Yep, I suggest you weigh your food. Sound crazy to you? I know how you feel. I used to feel the same way. Initially, when weighing and measuring was first suggested to me, I balked. It sounded obsessive and extreme. For years, I refused to do it. And I kept struggling with my weight. But then I tried it. And what I found was that weighing my food with a digital scale gave me tremendous psychological freedom. I didn't have to think anymore about what I ate after I ate it, or wonder if I'd had too much or too little. I knew I was getting the right amount of food. The value of that is that now, when I hear a voice in my head telling me to eat more, I know it's the saboteur. I weigh and measure my food precisely because that kind of precision can be automated. Every morning when I weigh my 1 ounce of oats, I weigh out exactly 1.0 ounces, not 0.9 and not 1.1. Because when you start to think, oh, that's close enough, you activate a part of the brain that's vulnerable to the saboteur. Is today's close enough the same as yesterday's? I had 0.1 ounces less of oats than usual this morning so I can have a little more fruit with lunch. No, none of that. We're committing to automatic and consistent. BLTs. In my world, BLT does not stand for a type of sandwich. It stands for bites, licks, and tastes. And they're the enemies of bright lines. I don't taste sauces bubbling on the stove. I'm not popping a piece of red pepper into my mouth as I'm making a salad. I commit to not taste my food until it gets to the table. In the early days, when I couldn't actually be in the kitchen without licking spatulas and nibbling on crusty bits at the edge of the frying pan, I even put scotch tape over my mouth to break the habit of eating unconsciously. Avoiding BLTs is important because you want to have real integrity with your food, and also because it's shocking how easy it is to nibble your way up a pant size. The history of bright lines and food addiction. The principles that I evolved into bright line eating were first introduced to me at a 12-step meeting for food addiction. I started adding 12-step food meetings to my schedule of other 12-step meetings at the age of 21, just 1 year after getting clean and sober. And what I want to share is that while I think the support and healing process of 12-step programs can be invaluable, I was not handed the blueprint for getting happy, thin, and free at meeting one. It took me 8 years of attending meetings on a near daily basis to experience lasting success. There are as many different philosophies about how to manage compulsive overeating and food addiction in 12-step programs as there are 12-step food programs themselves. Which is to say, at least seven. To my knowledge, the major 12-step food programs include Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous, Food Addicts Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Gray Sheeters Anonymous, CEA How, Anorexics and Bulimics Anonymous, and Recovery from Food Addiction. For the first several years, I attended a program that was focused on support. Its philosophy was not to prescribe a specific food plan. People would come to meetings and share their short-lived triumphs or what they'd binged on. They found comfort and mutual understanding, but most of us stayed heavy. Eventually, I moved on to another group that did have strict guidelines, and those guidelines helped me lose all my excess weight, for which I am profoundly grateful. However, that program was very rigid, and as I shared in the introduction, it nearly broke up my marriage. In fact, my husband left me for 9 months over it. Clearly, the way I was being guided to work that program was out of balance with my life. But I still needed both structure and community. I was confronting a common paradox of the 12-step food community. If a program is relaxed enough to accommodate a busy life, acknowledging that people have kids and other priorities, the less likely it is to work for any given attendee. The programs that seem to work really well for long-term weight loss tend to be rigid, even fanatical in their approaches. That said, for people who are willing to submit entirely to their structure, they do work. But the really interesting thing that I noticed over the years was something going on outside the 12-step rooms in the general population. Only a tiny percentage of the people I knew who needed and wanted to lose weight were interested in exploring a 12-step solution to their problem. For a long time, I assumed that they would come around, or would keep eating their way through a miserable existence if they didn't come out of their denial. But gradually I started to think differently. I realized that, first of all, food addiction is a continuum, as described by the susceptibility scale, and many of those people simply didn't have problems extreme enough to make them be willing to attend several weekly meetings and stand up in front of a room full of people and say they were food addicts. But also, 12-step programs simply aren't for everyone. Some people take issue with a God-based approach to recovery, and others just aren't joiners. This finally sunk in for me one sunny day in Rochester, New York, when I was walking with a dear friend who happened to be obese. She explained to me all the reasons why 12-step programs just weren't her thing. She would never go. I get that now. I also watched her weight yo-yo for well over a decade, and I very much wanted her to have a roadmap that would help her be successful. Brightline eating exists because it seemed like there needed to be an alternative. One that had enough structure to be permanently effective, but that could be flexible enough to allow people with busy lives to participate successfully. One with a strong commitment to science, and that would explain the reasons behind the guidelines, not just seem to assert them arbitrarily. At the same time, yes, it is possible for some people to get happy, thin, and free by going to a 12-step program. There are many of them, and I can't make a blanket statement about what works best because, A, it depends on your particular needs, preferences, and situation. B, odds are that not every program will have meetings near where you live. And C, the meetings for one program can actually be very different in different cities. But I can tell you what to look for if you do decide to check out a meeting. If there are a bunch of slender people there who show you pictures from when they were heavy, they have a sparkle in their eye and are eager to help you find a sponsor, you have found a home. If you go and there are lots of people in the room who are still quite heavy and have been attending meetings for years, move on. So what exactly are the differences between Brightline Eating and a 12-step program? Brightline Eating is based on science, features a powerful online support community, and conducts cutting-edge research to help shape our global understanding of the obesity pandemic. If you're a 10 on the susceptibility scale, you might find a home in a 12-step program that feels really comfy. You might want and need a sponsor, and prefer the face-to-face support of that live community. And meetings are free if finances are your driving concern. Also, you don't need to choose. Plenty of people have benefited from participating in both. I am a huge fan of support and resources. Whatever works for you to get and stay happy, thin, and free is what you should do.
Case study. Scott Steinhorst. Highest weight, 184 pounds. Current weight, 145 pounds. Height, 5 feet, 9 and a half inches. I was fit and trim through college, but I had an irritable stomach. I eventually discovered the symptoms were greatly improved by eating refined carbs and always keeping food in my stomach. This led to the habit of eating too much too often. For 10 years after college, I worked at a desk job as a mechanical engineer and software developer. Over that time, I slowly gained weight until I reached my highest weight of 184. I repeatedly tried to start exercise programs and learn more about eating healthy. My diet did improve over time, But I had little success with weight loss or regular exercise. I didn't feel like myself and was very unhappy with my weight. In 2001, I lost 30 pounds on the Body for Life program. But I didn't continue with the diet after the program, and the exercise plan fell away before long. A year and a half later, I quit my desk job to stay home with my kids, and gradually my weight started to yo-yo, going up 5 or 10 pounds in the fall and winter, then dropping every spring when I did a 3-week cleanse. But I became more and more aware of how little choice I sometimes felt I had over what or how much I ate. The winter of 2014 to 2015, I gained more than usual. Spring and summer passed with my energy and mood lower than usual. I completely failed to improve my diet, complete that 3-week cleanse, or otherwise lose the weight as I had before. I knew I needed to make a change. I just couldn't manage to do it. In the fall, I joined the Brightline Eating Boot Camp. Now I have the success with my food choices, my weight, and my health that I'd been trying so long to achieve. At first, making a food plan and writing it in my food journal each night was hard. Figuring out how foods matched up with the food plan and figuring out what to eat was also hard. But I made a deep inner commitment to stay perfectly within the bright lines. Perhaps this resonated so strongly with me because of Susan's emphasis on personal integrity and the negative psychological effects of failing with food. By halfway through the boot camp, organizing food and keeping my food journal was much easier. I understood the food plan and became acquainted with a variety of meals and foods I could eat. I found the simple preparation and arrangement of whole foods in Brightline Eating much easier and much less time-consuming than anything I had tried before, and I easily integrated it with feeding my family. My long-term brain fog cleared up very early on and has never returned. I felt weak, but not tired. In fact, I easily switched to decaf coffee, whereas I'd previously used caffeine and eating to keep up my energy throughout the day. A few weeks into the boot camp, my blood sugar stabilized, and I started experiencing the new and odd feeling of having steady energy all day long. I love to weigh my food. I take such great comfort from knowing I am, every meal and every day, eating exactly the right amount of healthy food. Without my scale, I would live back in the land of crazy, always wondering, should I have more? Is this too much? Am I losing weight? Gaining weight? Occasionally, I will scoop too much cooked oatmeal into my breakfast bowl, and it will occur to me to leave it there. And then my mind starts to wind up. Should I? Shouldn't I? Will it matter? Will it lead to more? Instantly, it becomes obvious how quiet my mind usually is, and how messing with the formula is a quick trip to crazy land. No way do I want anything to do with that. It doesn't affect my weight as much as it affects my mind. Out comes the bit of extra oatmeal, and I go back to the land of quiet freedom. So, thin, clearly, free, certainly, but happy? I've long fallen in and out of episodes of depression. In recent years, I've become more and more affected by this seasonal affective disorder, SAD symptoms here in Seattle. This winter, since I began Bright Light Eating, nothing. Not a whiff of the depression thing, or of the sad fall-winter thing. And for that, I am very, very grateful. Sometimes I feel a little pull now and then from non-BLE foods, especially from foods other experts recommend as healthy, like smoothies, juice drinks, kombucha, or recipes packed with super nutrients. I quickly remind myself they're express tickets to that life I don't want to live anymore. Food used to take up so much room in my life that I felt a sense of failure, like I was living someone else's life in someone else's body. Now I feel a sense of integrity. I feel successful. I feel like I'm living life as the best version of myself.
Chapter 7. Automaticity, Your New Best Friend. When people are first introduced to the concept of bright line eating, their initial questions, once they've gotten over the shock of being asked to give up sugar and flour, usually include, "But doesn't sticking to those bright lines require willpower? How on earth am I going to do that? Isn't this just another diet telling me which foods not to eat?" I tell them that this is absolutely not just another diet. The reason people lose their excess weight, and much more important, keep it off with this plan, is that bright line eating is carefully constructed to shift eating behaviors out of the part of the brain where decisions are made, the prefrontal cortex, and into the part of the brain where things are automatic, the basal ganglia. Bright line eating is a complete and integrated system. It does take some willpower to set up, but requires little to no willpower at all after that. Consistent repetition of bright line behaviors makes them become automatic. This is vital because we're trying to keep your saboteur quiet. We don't want you ever making decisions about what to do next. We want to set you up so that the crucial components of every bright line day are automatic. This accomplishes three goals. It keeps you at goal weight, takes the burden off willpower, and quiets the food chatter in your mind. There's nothing for your brain to figure out, puzzle through, or make a decision about. Choosing the right foods just becomes a habit. Habit in the brain. The brain evolved to make certain behaviors automatic. This frees up other parts of the brain for making decisions. Think of it this way. Kneeling in the dirt to tend crops or to make a fire left us vulnerable to predators. If we could perform those actions without consciously thinking about them, we could remain on alert for rustles in the underbrush and have enough mental bandwidth left to quickly decide whether it was a jackal or another tribe member approaching. The basal ganglia is the part of the brain responsible for that automaticity. What this looks like. The difference between using willpower and using your automatic brain to accomplish something is tremendous. If you've ever tried adding a new habit to your morning routine, exercise, 5 minutes of meditation, reading a page out of an inspirational book, you've probably experienced what it's like to forget, to get too busy, or to decide just to skip it one time. But now think about brushing your teeth. I don't know about you, but I predict that in a year's time, I will have accomplished brushing my teeth in the morning 365 times, regardless of traveling, illnesses, or work commitments. It's just non-negotiable. What's more, I don't have to think about it. I spend exactly zero energy worrying that I won't get it done. Contrast that to how my young daughters, Zoe, Alexis, and Maya, feel about the same task. They need daily reminders and cajoling to get it done. Why? It's not automatic for them yet. Do you remember when you first learned to drive a car and your first attempt at merging with the flow of traffic on a highway? Do you remember the heart palpitations, the focus it required? And now you can probably do it while drinking a latte and simultaneously changing the radio station. The point here is that once something becomes automatic, it frees up tremendous cognitive resources for other things. And you don't have to think about the behavior at all to get it done. The best part, in terms of staying true to your regimen, is that it will eventually feel uncomfortable when you don't do it. One of my friends got an oral night guard very late in life, and for 2 months she hated it. Now she can't fall asleep without it. There's no doubt about it, investing a few short months in muscling through the habits of Brightline eating until they become automatic is tantamount to giving yourself a gift that will arrive on your doorstep every day for the rest of your life. A lifetime of waking up happy, thin, and free. How long will it take? This brings us to the question of how long it takes to form a new habit. How long will it take for you to go from consciously remembering to weigh your food, to sit to eat at a table, approach your usual Dunkin' Donuts location and just keep on driving, to doing these things as a matter of course without even giving them a second thought? Let's use me as an example. I'd say I have a very full life. But I don't think about Brightline eating any more than I have to think about brushing my teeth. I just do it. But I did have to make an upfront investment to get here. The fact is that getting happy, thin, and free required me to focus really hard for a while on getting my food right. I wish there were a world in which people like me, and maybe like you, could eat whatever we wanted, whenever we wanted, all the time, and live happy, thin, and free. That world may have existed 1,000 years ago, but alas, it's not the world we live in now. So if you want what's on offer here, you're going to have to invest some energy for a while to get your food right too. How long does it take for us to form a new habit? Researchers wanted to know, so they asked subjects to start a new eating, drinking, or activity behavior and record whether they carried out the behavior each day and whether it felt automatic to do it. On average, it took 66 days for the new behavior to become 95% automatic. Note that this is in contrast to what you might have read or heard about in the media. No, it does not take a mere 21 days to form a habit, nor even 30. The true number is 66 days. However, that's just an average. The range is immense. On the low end, automaticity was achieved in as few as 18 days, and on the high end, 254 days. That means you're going to have to give yourself somewhere between 18 and 254 days to focus on this pretty intensely. Keep in mind, though, that the people in that study were asked to add one new behavior to their life. Getting happy, thin, and free is going to require adding several new behaviors, breaking many long-standing habits, and for some, kicking an addiction too. That's a big ask. Bunny slippers. So, during this period, before Brightline eating becomes automatic, I want you to be very aware of the stress you will be placing on your willpower and do everything you can not to overtax it. Reduce obligations at work if possible. Be conscious of the things you do that tap your resources, like moving your kids through their bedtime routine, and plan your Brightline meals accordingly. Either eat beforehand or have it laid out ready and waiting for you afterward. If you always got through a dreaded Wednesday staff meeting by relying on the pastry tray, eat your Brightline lunch beforehand. And make sure you're getting enough sleep each night. Sleep is a powerful willpower replenisher. Overall, in the early days, the rule of thumb is to travel gently. Imagine yourself going through your day wearing bunny slippers. That's the attitude I want you to take toward this early weight loss phase. You may feel very tired for a few months. That's normal, and it will pass. Drink a lot of water and know that the fatigue is real, but it's temporary. The time for feeling fantastic and being out in the world is coming, later. At the beginning, give yourself permission to be gentle with yourself. And a key part of that is no exercise. Yes, you read that correctly. Brightline eating is a no-exercise plan. During the initial habit formation phase, I strongly discourage people from increasing exercise levels. Doing so depletes willpower, which is dangerous to your long-term goals. It will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Once you are living happy, thin, and free, and Brightline eating is an ingrained habit, Adding exercise can have wonderful mental and physical benefits. Studies have shown regular exercise improves memory, attention, and learning capacity. It staves off Alzheimer's and other dementias. It boosts the immune system. It strengthens your muscles and your bones and can help with balance and protects against osteoporosis. It strengthens your heart. It increases self-esteem. It even improves your sex life. And once you're in a nice, slender body, it helps you to maintain that physique. Practically the only thing exercise doesn't do, it turns out, is help you lose weight. It's true. Exercise won't make you thin. In one study, Dr. Timothy Church at Louisiana State University assigned 464 overweight postmenopausal women into four groups. Each was assigned to work out an average of 0, 72, 136, or 194 minutes per week at an intensity of 50% of their peak VO2 max. There were no dietary modifications. At the end of 6 months, the exercisers hadn't lost any more weight than the zero-minute control group. As the amount of exercise increased, the body's compensation increased. Essentially, the exercisers got hungrier and their willpower was more depleted. This means their saboteurs were that much more successful in talking them into a post-workout latte and muffin. When you look closely at the science of exercise, the weight loss benefits just aren't there. And yes, I am aware that people lose a lot of weight on The Biggest Loser, but they don't keep it off, and that's the point. The reason to not exercise during the weight loss phase of Brightline Eating is that it's already going to take every last drop of focus and willpower you've got to establish thick, consistent, and totally habitual bright lines. If you're distracted or depleted in any way, you'll cut corners, let exceptions weasel their way in, and the whole endeavor will unravel. But if you give yourself the gift of this short period of time to really concentrate on this, you will reap the benefits for the rest of your life. In my view, weight loss should be a one-and-done thing, a very brief and unique time of your life. Let's get that weight off you once, now, and fast. Then you can go back to exercising and enjoy it in your right-sized body for the rest of your life. If you're still worried, I promise you that thousands of people in my boot camps have lost their excess weight without exercising. I've seen it with my own eyes. And I've seen the opposite, too. Participants in my boot camp were asked to characterize their level of exercise during the 8-week online program. Those who described their exercise level as sedentary had an average weight loss of 19.5 pounds, while those who described their exercise level as very active lost only 12.8 pounds on average. Increasing levels of exercise are associated with decreased weight loss during the period where people are learning new eating habits and trying to make them automatic. Other groups have found this too. In a study at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, researchers showed that during the first 8 weeks of their study, the diet-only group lost about 5% of their initial weight, while the diet-plus-exercise group lost only 3.5%. It's also important to recognize that exercise is part of the pathology for many of us. And here it gets tricky, because exercising is also a very healthy, empowering thing to do, and a thing we should do. But in my experience, many of the regular exercisers, not all, but many, who land in the Brightline Eating Bootcamp are pretty whacked out about exercise. Over-exercising to compensate for overeating can be an addictive cycle in and of itself. And they don't even realize they're doing it. But try to take it away from them, even for a few short months, even for a very good reason, and the neuroses start to surface. What we want at Brightline Eating is to get to a place where exercise is valued for all of its health benefits, but also totally and completely uncoupled from weight loss in our minds. They truly are not related. Now, there are exceptions to the no exercise rule. If you've been doing it every morning for 15 years and you do it as reliably as you brush your teeth, you get a free pass for obvious reasons. If it's not taxing willpower, it won't interfere. Similarly, if you've been diagnosed with depression or anxiety, the benefits of exercise may